Omaha Public Radio presents a program from the Kaneko Great Minds Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Cheryl Wudunn, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist with the New York Times and co-author of Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide. She'll be joined by Sweta Nuri, Afghanistan Country Director for Women for Women International. The title of their presentation will be Creating Hope Through Creative Opportunities, Obstacles and Opportunities for Women in Afghanistan. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, October 22, 2009, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of Kaneko, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Carol Kloss from KETV Channel 7.
I got to have lunch with our guests this afternoon, and we are in for such a wonderful treat. We have two dynamic, brilliant women with us tonight. You know, many of us in the United States are extremely spoiled. We take so many things for granted. The abundance that we have and all the freedoms that we have, often not realizing how good we have it, until we look to some of the developing countries around the world and see the many abuses, particularly women, face. And our guests tonight have seen these abuses firsthand. And they believe together that with our help, a collective help from the world, that things can change. And you'll hear from a very dear woman, Sweta Nuri from Afghanistan, an organization known as Women for Women that you'll hear more about. If you haven't read the book, you've already read about it. But first, we will hear from Cheryl Wudunn. I am so privileged to have met this woman, and her presence here tonight is so wonderful. She is author, lecturer, businesswoman. You can't even imagine that one person has done everything that she's done in one short lifetime, but she's still going. I mean, she's got lots more to do. She speaks Chinese and Japanese. She is a specialist in energy and alternative energy. She is a journalist. She was a journalist and editor for the New York Times, and she's the only person, from what I read, who actually worked in the news end of the New York Times and also the business end. And she is the first Asian American to win a Pulitzer Prize. She and her husband, Nicholas Kristof, won it for their reporting in Beijing on the Tiananmen Square protest of 1989. They are also the parents of three children. The latest book many of you have read, and many of them have been distributed throughout Omaha, Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide. I'd like to introduce to you Cheryl Wudunn.
It's great to be here in Omaha. I have always wanted to come here, so I'm so grateful for the opportunity to come here. And I can see through the rain, because I did spend 4 years in Ithaca, New York, which probably gets a lot more rain than here. So I know that there's beautiful trees, lush, and I hear rolling hills, too, in addition to the flatlands. So it also is wonderful to be here in this beautiful loft space. I thought I lived in the city with the most lofts in the world, New York City. But this is a wonderful loft space, and the artwork is amazing. The sculptures, the wonderful heads are so surprising to me. It actually reminds me when I used to go to the Chinese villages. There is a connection. In the Chinese villages, often you would walk by this very poor village with very wooden shacks, and then you'd come upon this statue. And you'd wonder, who is that statue of some famous person, some famous face? And it's often the local scholar who emerged, who made good, you know, went to the, grew up in the village and did some really good work in school, then was out, off somewhere to pursue education. So I also wonder who these faces are, Jun Kaneko. You'll have to, you know, apprise me of who those faces are in your heads here. But I'd like to take you far away from Omaha to a place probably almost the bottom of the earth. I mean, it's really straight down in China. very far away from the capitals, which perhaps many have been to, Beijing or Shanghai, away from the large cities, to the remote village in Hubei province, the Dabia Mountains. I'd like to tell you a story about Dai Manju. She is a 13-year-old at the time of the story, and she probably, that her age is about the only thing that she would have in common with any of your daughters or granddaughters. She was very poor. She lived with her parents, her two brothers, and her great aunt in a village. The house they lived in was a tiny shack. It had no electricity, no running water. They had no wristwatch, no bicycle. And they shared their very little shack with a very large pig. They lived in the same space, shared the same space, and it wasn't like this loft. She was going to school. When she got to about the sixth grade, her parents pulled her out of school. I mean, they hadn't had much education. They could barely read or write. And so they thought, well, why would we spend $13, which was the fee to send her to school, why would we spend $13 on a girl to educate her when she's going to be spending most of her life in the rice paddies or at home doing chores? So sixth grade, they took her out of school. Well, it turns out that Dai Manju was the best kid in the grade. And so the teachers were horrified. And Dai Manju would actually, even though she couldn't go to school, she would make the two-hour trek to the school. By the way, there were no roads to her village. It's basically walking through dirt. And so she would make the trek, two-hour trek to the school just to hang out there and sort of try and collect any tidbits of information that she could find. And any pencils that people would throw away, because she couldn't even afford pencils or paper. So we wrote about her story in the New York Times, and there were people poured in with donations, mostly checks for $13, because the New York Times readers are very generous in small amounts. But then there was a money transfer for $10,000. We thought, wow, hey, generous guy. Well, we brought the money to the village, gave it to the principal, who took that money, rebuilt the school. He made scholarships for all the girls, because all the girls were dropping out. And, you know, Dai Manju was able to graduate from the sixth grade, becoming the first person in her family ever to graduate elementary school. So we thought, wow, this is great. We'll report back to the donor. So we called up the donor, and we said to him, you know, you don't know what a difference $10,000 makes in the lives of poor Chinese peasants like this girl. And there was a long pause. He said, I didn't send $10,000. I sent $100. Well, being a good investigative journalist, I knew there was a problem there. Well, it turns out that there was a bank clerk who had a problem with decimal points. We hear he was later transferred to the Division for Subprime Mortgages. Well, indeed, he made a mistake. So we called up the officials at the bank. We called up this one senior official at the bank, and this is one example where we kind of used our authority as reporters. We actually said to him, okay, on the record, now are you really going to send your bankers to the Dabia Mountain School and take away all the money so that the girls can't go to school anymore? Well, under the circumstances, he said, we're happy to make a donation for the difference. So Dai Manju and her friends, they went on through middle school. They graduated middle school. They went on through high school, graduated high school. Dai Manju went to school for vocational accounting. And she then went down to the southern province of Guangdong and got a job in a factory as an accountant. She started sending money back to her parents, who then built a house, this time with running water, with electricity. They got a television. She started scouting around for jobs for her classmates. All her girlfriends who went down south, and they got jobs and sent money back to their parents who built houses. Pretty soon the village was really becoming prominent in the region, so prominent that it was able to get the government to build a road to connect it to the rest of China. So the village really stood out, and that was all because girls got educated. Because the other villages, who were still educating boys, didn't have the same result. So, that was a very special situation. In fact, I imagine, I wouldn't be surprised if you went to the Dabia village if you saw a statue of a bank clerk, not a scholar. But you know, that underscores how important educating girls is. And the fact is that if Daimanju were a boy, there'd be no question she'd be in school. But, you know, she was a girl, and so her parents did not want to send her to school. And that brings me to one of the two major arguments of Half the Sky. The first one being that, you know, we think the major moral challenge, the central moral challenge of our time is the gender inequity. It's basically the brutality that so many people in so many countries around the world face because of their gender. So, you know, Daimanju's story is not so much an education tragedy. It's really a gender tragedy. How far you get in school in a lot of these developing countries is not so much a function of how many IQ points you have. It's really a function of what chromosomes you have. And so we think it's really important to understand that in a lot of parts of the world, there is real gender inequity. So you might be thinking, well, boy, the central moral challenge of this century, of our time, this is kind of exaggeration. Hyperbole, right? I'm sure some of you are thinking that. So let me ask you a question. How many people here think there are more males or more females in the world? Let's actually see a show of hands, okay? How many of you think that there are more males in the world? Oh, a couple of hands. How many of you think there are more females in the world? Aha, a majority. There are actually more males. And that is because, demographers have actually tracked this, and Amartya Sen has done some seminal work in this. He won the Nobel Prize for this, that there are 60 million missing girls and women in the world. 60, and sometimes some estimates go all the way up to 100 million missing girls and women in the world. And there are many reasons for this. Basically, there is a sex-selective abortion, so that when the sonogram got to the developing world, families just said, my goodness, we don't have to have girls anymore. I mean, we have actually interviewed peasants in China that say, oh, we don't have to have girls anymore. And also there's violence against women. It often happens that when there also is not enough food to go around, who gets the food? Basically, when there isn't enough food, it goes to the boys. There are other reasons for women really being brutalized. Child marriages, there used to be concubinage. This woman, she had acid thrown at her by her husband in Pakistan. So there's just enormous amount of cruelty to women. But that brings me to the second major argument of the book, which is apart from the right or wrong of it all, on just a purely practical level, we think that educating girls and empowering women, bringing them into the formal labor force, is one of the best ways to fight poverty, to end poverty, and to fight terrorism. It's basically that when you educate a girl, in the long run, she carries that throughout her lifetime, she will basically have kids later on in life, she'll have fewer kids, and she'll be able to educate them better. Girls, really, and women are not the problem. They're really part of the solution. That's why we think empowering them really brings enormous dividends. It's really important to understand how critical this is. We often forget, basically they get neglected. Bill Gates put it really aptly. He was giving a lecture in Saudi Arabia and facing an audience much like you. And two-thirds of the audience were men. And then right here where the aisle is, there was a barrier. And on the other side was a group of women. So there was a barrier between the men and the women. So he got a question from the male side of the audience. A man stood up and said, "Mr. Gates, Saudi Arabia has one of its goals to be one of the top 10 countries in the world in terms of technology. Do you think we'll make it?" So as Bill Gates stared out at the audience, he basically said, "If you're not utilizing half the talent in your country, there is no way you will get near the top 10. So what would an agenda for this issue look like? What would an agenda for how to address this problem look like? At the top of the agenda has to be sex slavery. And I use the term slavery because that's really what it is. It's not forced, it's not just forced prostitution. We took a long time to come to this conclusion because we thought that word slavery really had sort of gone by the way, it sort of disappeared, thankfully, from our everyday vocabulary. But it really is slavery. I mean, we understood this intellectually that in much of the developing world, in places like India, in Cambodia, Southeast Asia, girls are kidnapped. They're captured and kidnapped, basically, and sold into prostitution. But it really didn't become real to us until we met Long Pross. Long Pross basically was kidnapped by a neighbor, sold to a brothel when she was very young. And when she resisted becoming a prostitute, the brothel owner just gouged out her eye. You know, this kind of thing happens too much in places like that. Many of you may know, have read some of the articles that my husband wrote, Nicholas Kristof, wrote about him purchasing two sex slaves. So he basically came about to do this when we were living in Japan. We lived in Tokyo, as I was explaining to Jun Keniko earlier, for about 5 years. And so Nick spent an afternoon in a brothel, as a reporter, of course. And he was interviewing two girls, one 14-year-old and one 15-year-old. And the 15-year-old was explaining that after she had been sold by the brothel, I mean, first of all, you know, they don't get paid at all. They barely get fed enough because the owners don't want them to look fat, so they don't even feed them enough. Anyway, so she was explaining that, you know, after she was forced into prostitution at this brothel, her mother searched all over Cambodia for her, all over for several years. And finally, just a week before Nick had gotten to the brothel, her mother had found her. And so Nick said, "Well, why are you still here?" And the girl said, "Well, the brothel owner told my mom that, you know, he had paid good money for me so that if she wanted me back, she would have to pay to get me back, and she didn't have enough money." So that just left a terrible, you know, feeling in Nick's heart, basically his stomach. He knew that he would go home with a front page story, but that those two girls would probably end up staying in the brothel and dying of AIDS. So the next time he went to Cambodia, he actually, before he went, he called up the New York Times and he called up the lawyers, and he said, "What is the New York Times policy on purchasing human beings?" The lawyer sort of scratched his head and said, "We don't have a policy on purchasing human beings." So the next time Nick went to a brothel in Cambodia, again, just as a reporter, he basically purchased two girls in separate brothels. He got receipts for the purchase of the two girls. He basically tried to set them free. We talk about their stories. They're long stories in Half the Sky, and they're ups and downs. But the essence is that you, with a little bit of help, they can really become productive assets in society. They really can. The second major item on the agenda would be maternal mortality. I don't know how many of you are familiar with some of the challenges in maternal mortality. Basically, one woman dies from childbirth every minute in this world. Every minute. That's the equivalent of about 5 jumbo jets filled with women dying every day from childbirth. It's really a global scandal. If men had uteruses, you can imagine what would be on the top of the agenda: paternal mortality. But these women have 3 strikes against them. They are poor, they are rural, and they are female. So they don't get attention, they are neglected, and they don't get the resources that is necessary to really help their problem. We have the method. We know how to prevent death in childbirth. We just don't have the political will. And even beyond that, in places like Niger, the entire country, 1 in 7 women die in childbirth, can be expected to die in childbirth. Sweda was saying earlier that in parts of Afghanistan, 1 in 6 women die in childbirth. It's really stunning. But even beyond maternal mortality, for every woman who dies in childbirth, there are about 20 women who are injured in childbirth. Obstructed labor. One of the worst kinds of injuries is called fistula, obstetric fistula. I know there are some doctors in the crowd. I don't know how many of you know what obstetric fistula is. It's a terrible situation. Let me tell you about Mahabuba. Mahabuba is in Ethiopia. She basically was 13 years old when she got married against her will to a man who then, she got pregnant with him when she was 13, and then ran away from him and then tried to have the child on her own, tried to have the baby on her own. Well, clearly her body was just not mature enough to have the baby, and she had obstructed labor and was left with a fistula, which means basically that she was incontinent. She could not control her wastes. So she smelled all the time. No one in the village would take her in. They didn't know what to do with her. So what they finally did was they took her and they put her in a hut at the edge of the village. And then they ripped off the door so that the hyenas would get her at night. So that night, she fought off the hyenas with a stick. She was 14 years old. The next morning, she dragged herself to the next village and she found a missionary that she knew was there, and he took her to the Addis Ababa Fistula Hospital, which repaired her fistula. So now Mahabuba is a nurse. They said they recognized that she was an intelligent, smart kid. She's now a nurse at that hospital, and she was helping hundreds, thousands of women cure their fistulas. So she became a really productive asset in society. So these women are, this is something that Secretary Clinton says all the time. Talent really is universal. Opportunity is not. But I've been talking a lot about some very depressing topics. I know they are. Let me talk about some of the solutions. One of the most important solution is economic empowerment. And a lot of you have heard about micro-lending, right? Economic empowerment, as I was mentioning early, when you educate a girl and you then bring her into the formal labor force, that just changes the dynamic. It takes a vicious cycle and creates a virtuous cycle. Women tend to pay back their loans more so than men. And they tend to take the money that they have from the loan and invest it in solid businesses. Research just empirically has shown some of that. Let me introduce you to Saima. Saima is a woman in Pakistan. She lived in a village outside Lahore, and her husband was not employed, and he used to take out his anger on her by beating her every single day. So she was really miserable. And on top of that, when she had her second girl, the mother-in-law basically took her son aside and said, "You know, you better take a second wife because Saima is just not going to ever bear you a son." So it just so happens that at that time, there was a microlending institution called Cash, and they gave her a $65 loan. $65, micro loan. So Saima decided to start an embroidery business, and it turns out she was pretty good at embroidery. And so the merchants started really buying up her stuff, really liked it a lot, and they kept asking for more. Well, I mean, Saima really couldn't do so much herself, so she started, you know, hiring other families. Pretty soon she had 30 families in the village working for her on her embroidery business. You know, she had so much stuff to lug from the village all the way to the marketplace that she ended up hiring her husband to do that for her. So her business, you know, he had a lot of gambling debts, so her business helped pay off those gambling debts. So now no one talks about, you know, taking a second wife, and she's not getting beaten anymore. And Saima just last month had her fourth baby girl. So that's another example of a very transformative experience. Education is also extremely important. And, you know, I told you the story of Diamond Ju. You know, in Africa, in Uganda, I'd like to tell you the story of Beatrice Bira. She lived in Uganda near the Congo border. Now, Beatrice had never gone to school. She was 9 years old, had not been to school because, again, her parents just didn't think it was worth sending a girl to school. And so it just so happened at that time there was a group of women at the Nyantic Community Church in Connecticut. And they made a donation to an organization, maybe a lot of you have heard of this, Heifer International. And so they sent a couple of goats, one of those to Africa, several goats, and one of those goats went to Beatrice's parents. So that goat had twins, so the twins started producing some milk, and they sold the milk and got cash. So as the cash started accumulating, her parents started thinking, well, gee, now we've got some money, maybe we should send Beatrice to school. Well, Beatrice was delighted. So here she was, 9 years old. She was going to school. She had to start in the first grade because she'd never been to school. So she was, you know, in class with the six-year-olds. She didn't care. Well, it turns out she was really, really smart. She rocketed to the top of the class. She stayed at the top of every single class every single year. And soon she became the first person in her village to come to America to study at college. And then in 2008, in June, Beatrice graduated from Connecticut College. You know, at her graduation, she said, "I am the luckiest girl in this world because of a goat." And you know something? That goat would cost $120. You can do so much for so little. I mean, she really is, it's really remarkable. But let me give you a reality check. You know, helping others is really hard. Aid has received a lot of criticism. There have been some books. You know, William Easterly has criticized the aid bureaucracy and how it doesn't work. You know, it's true. There are a lot of aid projects that just don't work. When you travel around, you're bound to see things, failed aid projects, you know, clinics that were built, schools that were built, and then a year later, there are no doctors showing up or only 40% of the teachers show up. It's true. There are those projects. But, you know, there have also been, anyone who travels around the developing world knows, there are also projects that work, you know, aid projects that do work. And so you've got to, you know, accept the mistakes that you make when you're helping others and just tinker with the process and try and make it better. So it can work. It does take a lot of work, but the results can be so remarkable and so transformative that it's actually really worth it. So what's in it for you? You know, it is probably, you know, we wrote Half the Sky because we really wanted it to be a do-it-yourself foreign aid toolkit. We really wanted to create a movement that people could join to help people like Beatrice, to send more goats to places so that, you know, families can actually have a livelihood on their own. And we have a website called halftheskymovement.org where we, you know, introduce people to some of the stories and some of the organizations that you can really do to help, to join to help. Because we do think that individuals can make a difference. But then what is in it for you? What is in it for you, not just people like Beatrice? There are very few things in life that can elevate, truly elevate your level of happiness once you have all your material things satisfied. Research really has shown this. There are very few things that can elevate that level, your set point for happiness. One of those things is contributing to a larger cause like this. So we hope that you will join the movement, be happier, and help save the world. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Cheryl. Well, and now we're going to get set up here for a conversation between Cheryl Wudun and Sweta Noori, who I want to introduce to you right now. Cheryl and Sweta come from very different places, but they both have a lot in common. One of the main things, they both believe that helping women is the single surest way to change the world. And as Cheryl said, what's so encouraging about their message is that we can achieve so much by doing so little. Sweta Noori is the Afghanistan Country Director for Women for Women International, and you'll hear more about this in their conversation. Under her direction, Women for Women programs have provided, and my number may not be quite right, maybe it's even more by now, but more than 8,500 women with financial assistance, education on human rights education, vocational skills training, and the microcredit loans that Cheryl referred to, many of them starting new businesses. In a recent autobiographical article, Sweta wrote, "I am only 36. I hope you don't mind if I give away your age. Is that still true? But already I have been a daughter, a mother, a leader, a war survivor, and three times a refugee." I want you to welcome tonight Sweta Noori.
First of all, thank you very much for your presentation, and I just have a question from you regarding your presentation and the book that you wrote. Being as an Afghan woman and a survivor from war in post-conflict countries, I see a lot of talented in post-conflict countries among the women. They need, of course, some polish and support from outsiders to improve their talents so they can bring lots of change, not only for their families, but the communities as well, and through the communities, the society, and their countries. So there was a very good presentation, and it's very strong. So my question would be, how long that took you to gather all these success stories and gather this and prepare that book?
It is a culmination of a very, very long time. It really started probably when, I mean, I can sort of reach back to when we started in China. And I was talking earlier this this afternoon about how when we were covering Tiananmen Square, and we actually saw, you know, it was terrible. We were outraged that there were, by our estimation, maybe 400 to 800 Chinese students killed on Tiananmen Square by the military. And that was horrifying to us. The next year after Tiananmen Square, we actually went to the countryside, and we roamed through the countryside and visited a lot of different rural areas. And we saw another horrific truth, which is that 39,000 baby girls were dying every single year before they reached the age of one. We had not devoted a single column inch to that. So we knew that there was something else going on there that no one had ever written about. And then we asked ourselves, well, why does journalism not write about these kinds of things? And it's just because these things are little things that happen every day. I mean, they're not little things, but it's just that the numbers add up over a whole year, but every day you see this brutality. So it's not news. It's just daily brutality. It's just hard to imagine this. Whereas an event that happens on a day, you know, is news because it's something that you can isolate and write about. So that was the beginning of us being able to realize that there's a lot hidden in what goes on in these countries that the newspapers that we as journalists tend not to write about.
Thank you very much. And my second question would be, have you been in Afghanistan and met with the Afghan women ever?
My husband has done most of the reporting in Afghanistan, and I have to admit that you and your colleagues are extremely brave. So I really, you know, applaud you and the work that you are doing. It really has to continue. And I really hope that Americans and individuals can actually help, because everybody can make a difference. It doesn't take that much to help just a little bit. Obviously, Afghanistan in conflict areas, it is very, very dangerous, and you do need security. I know you talked a lot about security before. You need security to do the work that has to get done on education and empowerment. So I hope that it can continue and that security will improve in areas where it's terrible.
Do you have any question from me?
Yeah, no. I mean, one of the questions that, you know, in Half the Sky, what we talk about is it is very important for fighting terrorism. Basically, a lot of research has shown that in conflict areas, when you have women who are marginalized, they're basically taken out of the mainstream of society. So what's left in the mainstream of society is men. And then when you have countries like Afghanistan and other areas where there is violence, when there's a surge, a bulge, a demographic bulge of young men, the society takes on, I mean, the only way to describe it, the society takes on sort of the characteristics of a men's locker room. it really is correlated with high levels of violence, wars, societies at war. And so when you have a society when women are marginalized, this is what happens. And so that's why bringing women back into the mainstream, educating them and bringing them into the formal labor force is so important. And how much of that do you see on a day-to-day basis in at least areas that are secure?
Actually, before I come to your question, I just wanted to tell that that's why our women are left behind, and these are not the reality, actually, that broadcast through the media to international communities, and it's in front of UN cameras. Like, if I go back to 8 years ago, there was some progress in developing toward Afghanistan, especially towards women's status in Afghanistan. Like, we have a parliament member as a woman, and in the parliament they have seated 28% of the parliament. We have elected women at the Central Region of Afghanistan. You have constitution that recognize women participation and women's rights in Afghanistan. So we have a good number of progressive things, but yet there is another Afghanistan, but that it's very unstable, violent, and in many ways very scary for the women that they live in my homeland country. Like, a lot of challenges the women are facing, like it took much courage for the women to run for the offices. They need to take approval from their husbands and their men's, family men's member. Once they get the approval, they face lack of the money to run for the offices. They are targeting, they are threatening by warlords and political parties. to run for the offices. Even in this recent election, presidential election, the security was worse for the, especially for worse for the women to go to the poll station and put their votes and select their future leader in Afghanistan. They targeted again, and in some families, the majority of the families, especially in southern area of Afghanistan, their mans, their husbands, took their votes and take it to the poll station, and they put the vote to whom they would like to vote. And domestic violence, again, how affect women in my homeland country. The women in Afghanistan, they do not feel that there is a safe place for them to go, because when they go to the government and complain against their in-laws' families or their families, they will be jailed. And what's happening in the jail, they will be raped. And they got pregnant as a result of the rape. They born that that baby in jail. So when they go out from the jail, they are not both. They are not acceptable for their communities and even for their families. So the one way that they choose, they finish their lives by pouring petrol on themselves and burn themselves. So last year in Red Cross and Hospital, I met with the 20 years old woman. She was 7 months pregnant, and she suffered such a great violence at the head of their husbands and in-laws family. She poured petrol on herself, and her health condition was very severe. And I couldn't talk with her because she couldn't talk at all. And when I asked her doctor, she said that her health condition is very worse, and she will lose her her life. So the forced marriages, as you described in your presentation, it's in my homeland country, and it the women in my homeland country, they need support, not only financial support but emotional support. Because one thing that I found from my country, when I talk with the women there, they feel that they are alone. There is no one behind them to support them. That's why they sit aside in a house and just they wait for their fortune.
Well, in many ways, that's why micro-lending works so well, in depending upon how the program operates. But often a micro-lending group would get together a group of women who then pool their resources. It depends on the way the program is administered. But they pool their resources, and then the one month, one woman gets the money, and then she invests it in a business. And she's shamed, basically, into paying it back because she's made all these friends with these women. But the more important thing also is that this group becomes a support group. It is true. They share ideas. I mean, they can actually share experiences and emotional fears and worries that they have about their own families and their, if there is wife beating, which often there is, that they share those experiences and how to deal with it, so they can share tips on how to deal with things. So the micro-lending groups become more than just a straight loan from a bank. I mean, they really become support groups that become very critical. And I know that Women for Women, you operate in similar fashion too, so it's very critical.
Exactly. Actually, I wanted to say some words about Women for Women International, that how our programs can help to move women from victim to survivor to active citizen. We are providing sponsorship program which matches socially excluded women with her sponsor based in the U.S. and Europe, and her sponsor providing both emotional support and financial support. It's a little amount of money. It's 27 bucks monthly, helping them to move from victim to survivor, to be survivor, and take a part in business. So one thing very interesting for the woman, that they never be connecting to each other. Even they are living in the community, but there was no opportunity for them to come together and talk to each other and share their views and thoughts and experience among themselves. So there's a group of 20 women that we organize them. They are coming twice a month and gather, and they are feeling that there is a new environment for the women, that all the women sit together, and they found this opportunity very important, that all the women comes with the obstacles, that when they talk about these obstacles, each woman just thought that this is the only issue that she faced, but now she heard that no, she is not alone.
She thought she was the only one, and now she finds everybody else has the same problems.
Exactly. Yeah. So they are sharing their experiences, and they find a very good solution. So, as you mentioned before,
right? And I think Women International, the model works so cleverly because it not only, for instance, individuals, Americans, can actually develop a relationship with a woman overseas. They pay $27 a month to help support that woman in whatever endeavor. Business endeavor she can find, or just in to support her home, and but it's not just that. They also write letters, so you get a pen pal. So you send money, but you also get a pen pal, and you write letters back and forth. And often, the relationship that is created through that letter writing becomes so special to both sides, not just the side of the women in Afghanistan, but also to the Americans. That you hear many people, many women and men here who develop those relationships say that, boy, I thought it was a one-way street. I was just giving the money, but in fact, I'm getting so much out of it. I get much more than $27 out of it. So that's one relationship they have. And then they also, the women in Afghanistan and other places, create a network of people in their home country that they just didn't know existed, could exist.
Yes, exactly.
What do you get for $27? What can a woman get with the $27?
Well, the women are getting $10 per month as a cash to support, like, for their transportation and some basic needs of them. Or maybe they can use that to support their families, like for their children's stationery, for their schools, clothes, and something similar with that. But the entire money goes to cover the right awareness training and job skill training, which is very important for the women to invest for their future. And some of the women are saving from that amount of money. And after 12 months, when they graduate from the program, they have a bunch of significant amount of money, so they can start their own small businesses. So we have. When the woman graduates from the program, they have a job skill already. So what they need to invest to capital to invest more on their small business. So they apply for the loan to our microfinance program. So this way they can support and invest to their small businesses.
You know, one of the biggest problems, and I'm curious how you actually help them save. Because one of the biggest problems is not just micro lending and micro borrowing, but also micro savings. Because certainly in places like Africa, when they get the harvest, they get the cash and they spend it right away. Often they spend it right away because there's no place to save their money. It's not like here in America, we have banks on every block, right? There are no banks there. So where do you put your money physically to save it? There are money changers who will go around and, hold your money for you, but they charge 80% interest rates. You know, that's usury, right? So the real challenge now is micro savings. And I know in India, entrepreneurs are really inventing lots of different products to meet the bottom billion, to really meet the services required by, the poor people in India. There are. I just noticed the other day that there's an entrepreneur who has invented a portable bank. Portable bank to, really facilitate micro savings, because it's so difficult. We just take it for granted that we can save, we can save physically if we wanted to. We don't always save, but that there's a place to save.
One thing in Afghanistan, as you mentioned, that there is no banks in rural areas. And in which way the women are saving their money, because it's very easy, to spend the money. And what they are doing, they are buying the gold. So this is, I'm telling you that whenever you wanted to travel to Afghanistan and you see the gold, the gold earrings and necklace, with the women, don't be surprised. It's a saving for the women. Whatever they need, the cash, they are going to the market and selling it and make it to the cash.
But they're carrying it on them. There's no place to put their savings.
Sometimes they are carrying with themselves. They are using as a fashion. But the main thing is to save their money.
Yes, yes.
To not be spending that.
I know one question that I'm thinking about in different projects that I've heard about trying to build a school, dig a well in a developing country, is the money problem. And some people are reluctant to send their money overseas because they don't know if it's going to be safe and if it's going to go to what they think it's going to go to. In Afghanistan, for instance, How would that work? What is the best way to get money to where you want it to go?
From outside, you mean the money outside from Afghanistan?
Yeah,
into
to send
Afghanistan.
Into the country for a specific purpose.
Well, I think there are many ways to invest in Afghanistan to support, actually, the civil society. Is spending money to civil society organizations who have access to the poorest of the poor people in Afghanistan, because we believe that when there is a change, positive change, lasting change appear from bottom to the up, will help the entire community to move toward development and sustainability. So it's a very good way to invest on the civil society organization. And in some ways, helping the government is also working, but unfortunately, in these years, I'm sure that you may have heard about the corruptions in the government. So the money through the government are not reaching, specifically not reaching Afghan women in far communities.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any ideas, Cheryl?
Look, as I mentioned earlier, aid really is hard to do. I mean, you make a lot of mistakes, and it doesn't always work, but it's still worth doing. So, I mean, in Half the Sky, we have a list of organizations at the back of the book, partly because it's just a starting point, but it's organizations that we've seen on the ground, and you know, the problem with the difference between help, you know, organizations here that help people here and organizations that help in the developing world is just the outcome difference. In other words, you know, it may take, maybe you take out 20% to administrative costs because getting to a place, getting money to a place so far away, so remotely, is difficult, but what you care about is outcomes. I mean, if you don't send it to this organization, there would be no outcome. So you really want to just get an outcome. You know, it doesn't matter if it takes a little bit more extra money that you're not getting your return on the investment of that specific dollar. But in the long term, it very well may be, and Larry Summers has said this when he was chief economist for the World Bank, it very may well be that the best return on your investment is to invest in girls in the developing world.
All right, thank you. Well, we could go on all night, but the night is growing on, so we need to thank our guests for coming tonight. Sweta Nori, Cheryl Woodham, thank you so much. We've learned so much. You've inspired us. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Kaneko Great Minds Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Cheryl Woodham, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist with the New York Times, and co-author of Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide. She was joined by Sweta Nori, Afghanistan Country Director for Women for Women International. The title of their presentation was Creating Hope Through Creative Opportunities, Obstacles and Opportunities for Women in Afghanistan. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, October 22nd, 2009, for broadcast at this time. The next programs in the Kaneko Great Minds Lecture Series will be this Thursday and Friday, November 19th and 20th, 2009, at the Kaneko Bow Truss. The speaker Thursday evening at 7 o'clock will be two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times columnist and co-author with his wife, Cheryl Wu Dunn, of Half the Sky, From Oppression to Opportunity for Women Worldwide, Nicholas Kristof. His topic will be Uncovering Human Crises, Crucial Dispatches from the Innovative Journalist. The speaker Friday at 12 noon will be Pulitzer Prize-winning Los Angeles Times journalist and author of Enrique's Journey, The Story of a Boy's Dangerous Odyssey to Reunite with His Mother, Sonia Nazario. Ms. Nazario will also join Mr. Kristof during the Thursday evening presentation. Special thanks to Heike Langdon, Kaneko Events and Community Relations Manager, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.